I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City becomes more diverse by the day, and it's caused some growing pains. ICE agents invited to a community meeting lead to distrust and tension, for instance. Police who lack training to deal with marginalized communities can discourage victims from seeking help. Today, the issues that reporters and advocates will be watching when it comes to diversity and inclusion in 2020. Later, the sports beat is the hottest beat in town. Obviously, there's a Super Bowl, but Royals Fan Fest also kicks off this weekend. We've got to discuss the brawl between K-State and KU last night. And did I mention the Chiefs are in the Super Bowl? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When it comes to the state of diversity and inclusion in Kansas City, there are lots of things churning around. The LGBTQ community continues to seek equitable access to public goods and services. Groups that advocate on their behalf struggle with distrust of law enforcement, and they are keeping a close eye on legislation that could undermine helpful steps that local governments have taken in recent years. Then there's the ongoing question of how to honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that we talked about yesterday on this program. Diversity and inclusion are issues that KCUR has included in its ongoing State of series that rounds up the big issues that reporters here will be following throughout 2020. With us here to talk about the state of diversity and inclusion are Michelle Tyrene Johnson. She covers this issue for KCUR. Michelle, welcome back.
Good morning.
Inoru Wade is the founder of the Midwest Rainbow Research Institute and board secretary for the Kansas City Center for Inclusion. Inoru, welcome back.
Wonderful to be here.
There's a lot going on in our listening area when it comes to these issues. Michelle, to what extent, and if you can characterize it in any way, is progress being made, or to what extent are we moving the wrong way? How do you begin to size it up?
I think that people get really into comparison, like, things are better today than they used to be. And that really isn't helpful. That's like someone who has broken their right leg and someone says, well, it's better than that one time you broke your thumb. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you're in pain or if you're having problems getting through your life because of any kind of either discrimination or a sense that things in your society are just not going in your direction, it just your old pain doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. You know? And Oru, how do you see it?
I'd say it in the same light. I see us making some steps forward, but then other people and other groups are undermining that and pushing us back. And so we sort of find ourselves stagnated.
Which is the typical pattern. We've talked about that on this show any number of times. Progress, then regression, then a couple steps forward and you move back again.
Yeah, absolutely. We see local governments taking steps for non-discrimination ordinances, banning conversion therapy, and then the next day the state legislature or another group says no and tries to push it back. And all of these steps we're taking are just steps. The goal is still pretty far away.
You know, one of the objections, what you're trying to achieve with the Midwest Rainbow Research Institute is training law enforcement in how to best engage with your community. What kind of training do you think is needed here?
Right now, we are focused on a very intensive 3-hour training. We are the first organization in the state of Missouri to be certified by the state to engage with law enforcement agencies with their continuing education program.
Are law enforcement agencies taking advantage of it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very important. We're seeing an onslaught of violence towards our trans women of color, towards LGBT people in general. And it's very important that you have a law enforcement agency that is able to administer justice for victims of hate crime, sexual assault, and rape.
You know, they also told us before the show that there is a concern that victims of rape, sexual assault, and hate crimes are simply attempting to ignore what they've gone through rather than seek justice. Hearing that's going to jar some people. What's happening out there?
You have a combination of a cultural sense of shame regarding sexual orientation and gender identity. So people feel ashamed of who they are. And if you feel ashamed of who you are, you don't actually believe psychologically that you deserve anything. And justice is one of them, number one. And then the flip side is that we don't necessarily have public institutions that understand the communities that they're serving. And therefore, if I go to the law enforcement and I say, hey, I've had this terrible incident happen to me, and if that law enforcement individual or agent or officer doesn't understand who they're actually dealing with in terms of the historical precedents and everything else that's happened to this community, they're not going to be equipped to actually handle the case going forward.
You would think, given all the attention to just what you described, that maybe that paradigm has begun to shift, and you're suggesting that,
I think culturally, with our popular culture and social media, Hollywood, books, movies being a lot more inclusive towards LGBTQ plus people, more people are coming out. But that does not mean our political culture and public institutions are just as progressive in their steps going forward.
I mean, on one level, that strikes me as a pretty powerful indictment of the law enforcement community in these parts. Am I right?
I wouldn't say that it's an indictment as much as it is. We have an unprecedented amount of people coming out. So what used to be a small minority of people are actually gaining traction. If you look at Kansas City, we have about 2 million people in the metro area. And then if you look at statistics regarding sexual orientation and gender identity, there are some polls and surveys that have us at 20% of the population. If we just put it at 10%, that's 200,000 people. And most Midwestern red states are just not equipped to service that community.
Michelle, this all strikes me as a story that you'll be following closely throughout 2020.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, my beat is race, identity, and culture. And there are people who are like, what does that mean? And that basically encompasses any way your life, whether it's your race, your sexual identity, your sexual orientation, any way your life is impacted by who you are. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you know, to me, that's what privilege is. You know, people talk about white privilege, but privilege separate from race is about what you don't have to think about, which is why white privilege is probably the biggest privilege we talk about. But it's all kinds of privileges. I mean, even, you know, like for someone who is married, who's a woman married to a woman or a man married to a man, if you have to hesitate about putting your picture on your desk, then that's a privilege you don't have. Mm-hmm. If you as a person of color have to wonder about the political climate and what decisions and choices that people, elected officials, are making because of your race and how that disproportionately impacts people in your group, that's a privilege you don't have.
And Inoru, you're suggesting that these struggles continue day by day, week by week.
Yeah, absolutely. They don't just go away with a simple vote on a piece of legislation out of City Hall or out of the state legislature. Those are just first steps to a longer conversation and process we need to have within our community about including diverse populations.
Is that conversation happening?
It's starting to. Between my organization and other nonprofits that are serving LGBTQ plus people, what we're trying to do is not only engage public institutions on how to serve marginalized communities, but we're also attempting to put forth different programming to empower those marginalized communities to realize that this is your government too, these are your services too, and they should be catering to the needs that you have.
We're talking about the ongoing state of diversity and inclusion in the Kansas City area. Michelle, I wanted to ask you about developments in the Latinx community last year. You know, that community dealt with one of the most prominent nonprofits in our community actually inviting Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agents, ICE, to a community meeting. That, of course, caused all manner of distrust and tensions within that community. Remind us what happened there.
If Maddie Rose, if I recall, I've been, as you know, knee deep in another project.
Yes.
But they invited members of ICE, you know, the immigration law enforcement people, to a community meeting, and that made a lot of the folks in the community who are of Latino descent, who have various degrees of connections with immigration, whether it's their own, mm-hmm. a relative, a family member, maybe a neighbor, to feel unsafe. I mean, that's something that a lot of communities deal with. I mean, if in the Black community, when there have been times when people have invited the police officers, it's not that, that folks are anti-police, but in a safe space where police officers or immigration officials don't make you feel safe, then that can be really a challenge because you're going someplace thinking, oh, this is a place where I can openly be, and oh, all of a sudden now I have to be worried about what may happen to me.
How has all that been resolved as 2019 rolled along? Any resolution there or not really?
I don't know if there is any resolution. I mean, I think it's just a matter of rebuilding trust. I mean, I think a lot of organizations are rebuilding trust. You know, on the Latinx community, the whole issue with Kemper and UMB Bank and, you know, the investment in a private prison. I mean, those are those things that may back to privilege. If that's not something that's part of your world, then you may not think twice about it. But if you're someone who you've seen how your family is impacted by that, then it immediately catches your attention and you have things to say about it.
You know, meantime, several communities are dealing with a fallout over the removal of Dr. King's name from the Paseo. You just traveled the world literally looking at this issue. Those stories are at kcur.org. You know, regardless of what people think about whether this was the right move or the wrong move, to what extent did this controversy create tensions within the city and even inside the African-American community?
Oh, boy. We got another half hour, Steve?
I'll give you 3 minutes.
I'll make it quicker. I think in particular with the Black community, it causes divisions because I did a story on how there are members of the Black community who wanted to keep Paseo, that name, because it was, Paseo is a name, is a neighborhood, is aspirational. It means something. But then you've got members of the Black community, a lot of them led by Black ministers, who were like, no, we need to honor Dr. King, and why wouldn't we pick a fabulous street to do that? Mm-hmm. And as you and I sort of informally talked about the other day, I mean, this is a whole new world where, you know, in the Black community, when Black ministers say something, that it isn't the thing that everybody else follows. I mean, mm-hmm. this is a little bit controversial right now, is just how in the Black community in 2020, we don't have the same allegiance to the same kinds of leaders anymore.
That's interesting. In Oru, your organization is keeping close watch on legislation in both Kansas and Missouri state houses when it comes to LGBTQ issues. What are you watching? What are you keeping your eyes out for?
Well, right now we're seeing two out of Jefferson City, one from legislation about creating parental boards for library programs, which is a direct backlash to all of the inclusive programs that local public libraries have been putting on to be equitable with their access to LGBTQ plus people.
And lawmakers are looking at legislation on that front?
It's already been drafted and filed. Whether or not it goes through committee is up for grabs, but it would give the ability to jail librarians for certain content that the library holds, which is sort of asinine when you think about a library, mm-hmm. As well as legislation that would require individuals in high school and middle school to participate on sports teams according to their sex at birth rather mm-hmm. than their gender identity.
Why is that a concern? Explain that one.
The reason why it's a concern is you're finding it's mostly an ignorance on the part of legislators who don't understand what gender identity actually is as it relates to the human body. And so it becomes a problem because you're forcing people to identify in ways that they don't. And what that actually does is it hurts your sense of empowerment. We value sports in this country. We always have. It's a sense of teamwork. It's a sense of community building and a whole host of other things. And you're essentially barring kids from actually being able to participate in that culture and gain a sense of pride and empowerment in their abilities.
How do you plan to overcome that?
One of the things we do is at the request of individuals and state lawmakers, we will go in and testify on behalf of it. I'm a policy scholar by trade, so I look at potential legislation and policies that are going to be enacted and look at the pros and cons of them and tell you exactly why they're bad or why they're good. And so
I think if you put that issue to a vote of Missourians, I think you'd be on the losing side of that right now.
Perhaps, but that's why our organization is dedicated to promoting equality through enlightenment. I believe thoroughly that if you sit people down and have an honest conversation and take in all of the questions, regardless of how ignorant they might sound, you can actually change a lot of people's minds using facts and logic.
Another big issue is employment and the realization that some goods and services are still being denied to members of the LGBTQ community. What about that one?
Well, what we're seeing right now is you have people who have not had traditional access to employment. People who, because of growing up in the closet or because they're shamed, they don't feel as if they're even worthy of having certain careers. And that's destructive to a community, number one. And we're also dealing with the fact that employers don't understand the value and talent that the LGBTQ plus community can bring to their organizations, to their businesses.
I'm wondering, given all these concerns, how your organization manages to set priorities?
Well, that's a very interesting question.
Yeah.
It mostly depends on who contacts us. I know the Kansas City Center for Inclusion is very focused in 2020 on creating everyday programs, including a job fair, partnering with human resource management organizations across the metro to empower people when it comes to resume building, cover letter, and mastering interviews so that whenever we do roll out our annual job fair at the end of summer, early fall, that every single person who's participated in those programs is prepared and ready to go.
You know, Michelle, one of the organizations that you mentioned in your piece on diversity and inclusion is Operation Liberation. What is Operation Liberation?
You know, it's really interesting. It's a project within One Struggle KC, and you know, the average person in Kansas City, if they're in jail on bail, it's $200 to bail them out. And you know, speaking for myself, I am far from rich, but if I was in jail for something and it only took $200 to get me out, there's a whole bunch of people I could call. But there's a whole bunch of people that can't. $200 keeps them in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And so Operation Liberation is this program to raise money to get people who are out on like really minor things. We're not talking, you know, hardened criminals with felonies, but somebody, maybe it's a traffic ticket, something they couldn't pay. Because seriously, if you're poor, regardless of what color you are, everything snowballs into something that can impact. And if you're in jail for something like $200, that may cause you to lose your job, which then is a whole nother set of dominoes. So they've raised enough money to just get out a couple of people just since the new year.
Hmm. Another issue that you're following in 2020 is this idea of women power. This is the 100th anniversary of women winning the right to vote. Your story says the country is already seeing more rallies and organizing this year. What are you seeing there?
Well, and as you, if you're looking at my internal communications, the 100th anniversary of white women's right to vote.
Fair point. Yeah.
Just since 2016, I think that there's been a focused intention on more rallies. I know Justice Gaston, who's a local activist, she just helped have a rally that focused on women and women of color in particular. Over 500 people showed up this past weekend, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so this is the 2020. We've got Shirley Kitchen's Cabinet, which is a black woman's organization, advocacy organization, that's putting the push out for more women, black women to vote, which, you know, black women already, anyway, vote and vote in high numbers. And so I think that this is going to be a year with this upcoming key presidential election and then all the other elections that are important, not just presidential, where women, even more than usual, I think are going to get out in really effective ways, at the very least, rattle some cages.
That's Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Her piece on the state of diversity and inclusion will publish online tomorrow at kcur.org. It's the last in KCUR series on the state of Kansas City in 2020. You can follow coverage on these topics at kcur.org and on 89.3 FM throughout this year. I also want to thank Inoru Wade, founder of the Midwest Rainbow Research Institute. Thank you both for the update. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
After a short break, KCUR contributor Greg Eklund joins us, and we'll talk about that big brawl last night at the conclusion of the KU-K-State basketball game. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. There's a lot on my mind after each program. My weekly newsletter, Kraske Off Mic, is the place where I share those thoughts. Visit kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe. It's quick. It's easy. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on our program, meet the former UMKC dancer who landed a gig in a production of the Lion King musical. It completely changed the way she thinks about Broadway. Hear her story tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, KCUR contributor Greg Eklund is back with us to round up area sports news, and it isn't like there's not a lot to talk about here. KU and K-State played a game of basketball last night, and they did a little bit of fighting, too. We'll find out what that melee at the end of the game portends for the rest of the season. The Royals have their annual fan fest this weekend downtown. Last I heard, the team has a new owner who will have an opportunity to interact with fans at FanFest. And yes, there's a thing called the Super Bowl coming up in another 10 days. Greg Eklund, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve.
You got some breaking news this morning concerning your Kansas City Royals.
Alex Gordon, according to MLB.com's Jeffrey Flanagan, has signed a one-year contract to return to the Royals for another season.
That's not a huge surprise, is it?
No, I think if he was going to play at all, I think it would have been with the Royals.
He wanted to stay with the team.
I don't think there was any desire to go anywhere else. If he was not going to be playing for the Royals this season, then he could have retired. But he's coming off another Gold Glove season. He clearly has the skills in the outfield still. His batting average was better. It's not spectacular. They're going to need other guys in the lineup to pick up the offense. But it's not like he's a slouch at the plate either. He hit 13 homers last year, so he's solid, but not spectacular from the plate.
He batted .266 with those 13 dingers that you just mentioned. And to your point, he just won his 7th Gold Glove Award. Has any Royal ever won more?
How many did Frank White win?
8. It's in my notes.
Yeah.
I did my research last night, just in case I stumped you with that one. Yeah, Frank White won 8, so Alex Gordon has a chance to tie that record.
Sure, this year. And there was no sign last year with his abilities to cover the outfield. He's also a smart ball player. He knows how to play the hitters. He knows what angles to take when he's tracking down a fly ball. Not only with the skills that he has, with what's left of his skills, he makes up with his uncanny ability to be in the right place at the right time.
Do we know how much money he got for this one-year deal?
Reportedly, again, by Jeffrey Flanagan, 4 years, $4 million for this year. He's coming off that four-year contract in which he earned $72 million, so it's considerably less. He would have made, if the option was picked up this year, $23 million, but the Royals paid $4 million to buy him out.
But he's making almost the public radio wages now at $4 million a year, right?
Right.
Wow, $4 million. And that's a down year for him. Well, we'll get to the latest developments with the Chiefs in a few minutes. I mean, I want to start, though, with that bitter intrastate rivalry that played out again last night in Lawrence. I'm talking about KU taking on K-State. KU won the game easily, but not before a wild fight at the very end of the game under one of the baskets here. Greg, bring us up to speed. What happened last night?
Well, the final seconds are ticking off. Silvio De Sousa has the ball. Deshaun Gordon, a freshman for Kansas State, steals the ball, goes to the other end, and when he goes up for a layup, De Sousa, who had the ball stolen from him, blocks it, but not only blocks it, then he's standing over him and taunting him.
Which is a huge no-no in sports, whether it's college sports or the NBA for that matter.
So he gets the technical foul later on, much later on, after all this was sorted out, for taunting. But at that moment, everything was happening so fast, then the fists start flying.
And at one point, De Sousa picks up a stool of some kind.
That was an ugly scene.
And he appears like he's ready to club somebody with it. And fortunately, someone, maybe an assistant coach, grabbed that stool before the thing flew.
Yeah, and that's the image that is going to be the lasting image associated with him. It's not a good image. It was embarrassing for KU. It shouldn't have happened. Both coaches agreed to that, but it did happen, and now there are going to be some disciplinary measures handed out. We don't know what yet.
Well, embarrassing is almost an understatement here.
Yes, sure.
Given it's the lead sports story in the country, both teams from Kansas, this is a black
eye. For a game that didn't really, at that point, mean anything. It was already decided.
Lots of talk on ESPN last night that the penalties could be even Silvio De Sousa not playing again for KU this
year.
That's
possible.
Would that make sense?
Sure. I mean, again, you know, this is an image that's going to be associated with Kansas. It's a damaging image. Mm-hmm. He is already, not directly, but he is already... been the center point of a lot of headaches with the Kansas Jayhawks. This is not any better.
If our listeners have thoughts on what's an appropriate punishment here, I'd be curious to hear it. 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Who imposes the penalties here, Greg? Is it KU? Is it the NCAA? Is it both?
Well, I think more the Big 12 Conference.
The conference, okay.
KU will impose its own penalties, but it may be superseded by what the conference decides.
When would you expect those to come down?
I would think maybe in the next 24 to 48 hours. Kansas has a big game this Saturday against Tennessee. It's going to be the Big 12 SEC matchups, and... game day, ESPN game day is going to be on site in Lawrence, Kansas on Saturday. Mm. So I would imagine that there's going to be something known before Saturday.
How key of a player was De Sousa, and what might this development mean for the team's prospects of going to the Final Four?
Actually, he has the potential to be a really good player, but
Seen it yet, though, right?
No, we haven't. He's seen limited minutes because there are two big men that are getting the majority of the time on the floor for KU, David McCormick, who was also involved in the fight last night, and Udoka Azubuike. Mm-hmm. So because of the play of those two, De Sousa's minutes have been limited this year.
I can't help but wonder, to what extent does something like this reflect on the coaching staffs of both teams? I mean, or does it at all?
Well, both coaches were at center court shaking hands as a gesture of good sportsmanship at center court because they thought that the game was going to be ending. And then all of a sudden, Bill Self finds himself at the end of the court trying to get his players out of there during the middle of this melee.
Mm-hmm. Can you make a case that Bill Self has lost control of the team?
No, I don't think he could make that case. This is an incident, as Bill, he was very upfront about it last night, which I should say also that KU released a statement. The athletics director was there too, Jeff Long. Instead of getting front and center of the cameras and addressing how deplorable this was last night, he chose to issue a written statement, which I think if, you know, you're the athletic director and this is at your arena, you need to be front and center as well as Bill Self was last night.
The statement, though, was pretty contrite, apologizing point blank for what had occurred.
To the Big 12 Conference, which is going to be imposing the penalties, to his counterpart at Kansas State, and to Bruce Weber, the K-State coach.
Okay, what penalties should be handed out in the wake of the big brouhaha last night in Lawrence between KU and K-State? Fists flying, stools raised in anger. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Jack from Mission, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for covering this. I think you guys are doing a good job. The only thing I would say is that the K-State bench clearing immediately after De Sousa standing over the guys is kind of what triggered the whole thing. So I don't think that should be overlooked when penalties are assessed. And I would say that both De Sousa and the K-State guys who initially ran out there first should get at least 5 games each. And I'll take my reaction off the air. Thank you very much, Jack.
And, I mean, arguably, if you're a teammate of the K-State player who had his shot blocked, he's lying prone on the court as D'Souza stands over him. The argument would be they were running to his defense.
Technically, both benches were ejected last night because both teams left the benches. It's a rule. If you leave the bench to join a fight, you are ejected. Both benches were ejected. Technically, they put 1 second back on the clock to finish out the game because they did that by rule. So D'Souza got a technical foul, but by the rules, both benches were ejected from the game.
I mean, from watching it myself, there isn't much doubt that D'Souza was the instigator here. He looms over the fallen K-State player, and that's, again, that's a no-no in the college sports. You don't do that.
For which he got the technical foul, and then everything followed that. But there will, and the Big 12 will have to consider that well. When players leave the bench, as they did on both sides, how much consideration is that given to the penalties that'll be imposed?
But again, a lot of folks thinking that D'Souza is not going to play again for KU this year.
It's possible, sure.
Talk about a checkered career here. That's just amazing, his time at KU. Mindy tweeted this. Let's not forget that KSU, K-State threw the first punch. The behavior was bad on both teams, but it's not fair to disregard K-State's conduct here.
I don't think K-State's conduct is disregarded in this instance.
Did K-State throw the first punch? Do we know that?
Antonio Gordon kind of got in the middle of this as kind of a go-between between D'Souza standing over Deshaun Gordon on the ground. Antonio Gordon, a teammate of, he starts...
Who didn't even play in the game, I don't think.
Saw limited, if at all. He really wasn't a factor in the game, but K-State really wasn't a factor in the outcome. Anyway, the game was decided in the first half. But then, both... there were K-State players involved in this, too, Antonio Gordon being one of them.
Okay, well, we're getting some talk here from our producer that K-State shoved first, that sort of, again, began that aspect of all this here. But no doubt the black eyes are a lot of bad imagery here for both Kansas's premier schools here.
Yep.
Yeah. Looking at the game itself, this was a pretty lopsided deal. What's happened to K-State? Because it appears to be in something of a rebuilding year after being pretty competitive with KU the last few years.
Very much in a rebuilding mode. They started out 0-4 in the Big 12 Conference, which has not happened under Bruce Weber's tenure. They had an upset win over the weekend against West Virginia, which was a big win for K-State. Mm-hmm. They have a couple of nice young players who are going to be, and in fact, Deshaun Gordon, the guy who was on the floor at the end of the game, he's only a freshman, and he had his best game of the year last Saturday against West Virginia. So K-State has a couple of, they're just asking young players to grow up fast. And in this instance, as Bill Self said after the game, there are examples of immaturity on both sides, and we clearly saw that last night.
Now, even before the season began, Greg, KU was under this cloud of the NCAA investigation. The NCAA had alleged a series of major violations against the school and even Coach Bill Self, including lack of institutional control. The penalties could be severe, at least that's some of the talk. Where do we stand today with all this?
Ongoing investigation. It may not be known till next summer, the outcome of this. But
so it may not affect this season at all, then?
Not likely this season. If down the line that the NCAA deems that KU used a player who shouldn't have been playing, there might be, some games that are eventually on the floor. They were decided with wins and losses, but they actually may be expunged in the record books.
Is the expectation that Coach Self himself could be face suspensions here?
It's possible. I mean, you can't rule anything out. These are serious allegations. It's an ongoing allegation, and nothing is ruled out at this point.
But again, your expectation is we won't see any ramifications here this season. It very likely could be during the offseason going into the next
year. That's what I would anticipate,
next year.
Yes.
Okay. Is Coach Self talking about this whole deal very much?
He addressed it at the Big 12 meetings in Kansas City here before the year. And as expected, he is directed not to comment really directly on the investigation. So,
but he continues to refute a lot of these allegations.
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure.
And I should point out one more thing. The football team has also been implicated here.
Well, that was under David Beatty. The
former coach.
Correct. Who has preceded the current coach, Les Miles. So, yes, the football team is also under investigation. Not real good times off the floor for KU.
I was going to say, what did you think of Les Miles' first season as the KU football coach? I mean, the team was 1-8 in the Big 12 conference, which struck me as pretty typical for a KU football team.
The record is typical. But I think if anybody who saw KU play in the field, they saw a team that competed better against the opposition. You know, there were a couple of blowouts thrown in there that you would have anticipated. But I think there were signs of progress even with the players that he inherited. And now he gets to put his fingerprints on the team as we move forward.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and I'm visiting with KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund about a whole host of topics. Let's turn to a happier topic, perhaps. We'll talk about the Royals here, which is holding its annual Fan Fest event downtown this weekend. What is Fan Fest? And should I go?
Well, sure. I mean, if you're a baseball fan, I think you should go. It's one of those deals that this is referred as the hot stove season, because in the middle of the winter time, when nobody can do anything outdoors, and you want to get a sense of baseball and the game and the things involving baseball, it's time to go inside to the Kansas City Convention Center, and there are displays there. You listen to some onstage interviews with some of past and former players, and there are players signing autographs there. It is what it's designed to be. It is a festival for the fans as they're on the verge of, it's just around the corner, going to spring training.
Well, thank goodness for that. who's going to be there? Do we know?
I know they put a schedule out there. I know there are, I think I saw a list of like 30 players, 30
no
current
kidding.
Players that are going to be in town. A lot of them coming in from out of town. And then, of course, they'll have some big announcements like today. This plays into the Fan Fest with today's announcement on Alex Gordon agreeing to a contract for the upcoming season.
Would it be safe to assume that the team's new owner, John Sherman, will be at
I would
Fan
think
Fest?
So. There hasn't been anything official on that or announced on that, but I would think that this would be a great opportunity for the new owner to put himself in front of the fans.
Sure.
We've
yeah.
heard his voice. We've seen press conferences. We've seen sound bites and audio clips and video clips. But for a face-to-face meeting, a Fan Fest of this nature is the perfect opportunity for him to interact.
Do these events draw big crowds?
They do.
Yeah.
Well, of course, it was huge coming off the World Series in 14 and 15.
Yeah.
So it's been down a little bit since then because the team has been down. But they usually do still draw very well because of what people refer to as the baseball fever.
Baseball fever. I love that. Well, when does spring training begin?
Late February. It's not that far off. I mean, probably just, I think it's just like a couple weeks after the Super Bowl. So it's hard to think about because of the Super Bowl coming up. But yeah, just a couple weeks after that, they'll be reporting pitchers and catchers first down in Arizona.
That's what you always like to hear. You know, as the team gathers this weekend, what are the big questions that hang over the organization in terms of the team that will be put on the field this year? What storylines might we be hearing about come springtime here?
Well,
Greg?
it was not a splash signing, but there was a guy who was signed this offseason. His name is Michael. I hope I'm pronouncing his first name correctly, but his last name is Franco. He's a third baseman. Signing him as a free agent, he's going to make roughly around $3 million this year. He hit 17 homers last year, had 56 RBIs. He's going to be the everyday third baseman, and that's going to enable them to move Hunter Dozier to right field. So we're going to probably have an outfield of Dozier and Wright, Whit Merrifield in center, Gordon in left. Solaire will probably play some right field, but going to be more often the designated hitter. Plus, we have another storyline of Salvador Perez coming back from his Tommy John surgery, so he'll be back behind the plate. I would think that the Royals are going to have a rotation at first base as well. Dozier could play there. Maybe Salvador Perez could see some time there to relieve his time behind the plate of throwing all the time behind the plate.
Do we expect that Salvi will be 100% here after that?
I think
that,
so. He's been working. You know, he had the full season because of the surgery, he couldn't play. So he's been working out, and I think we could expect a full recovery.
You know, we're also awaiting news on the signing of a new TV contract. I asked Mr. Sherman about that when he was here a few weeks ago.
And they said very soon.
Very soon. When do you expect that? I mean, and
I'm kind of surprised it hasn't been made already.
As I am, yeah.
But I think the FanFest is the perfect forum to make such an announcement. I'm going to make an educated guess and say that we're going to hear something this weekend on that.
Let's just quickly turn to the Super Bowl as if that topic isn't getting enough coverage right now. Yeah. The Chiefs stand as 1-point favorite based on the latest odds I've seen. That means the odd makers are thinking this is something of a toss-up of a game. You were on the show Monday proclaiming for all the world to hear that you expect a blowout here with the Chiefs on top. You still sticking with that?
I'm sticking with my guns on that.
Yeah. You've covered Super Bowls before. As someone who's covered more national political conventions than I can remember, I know that these major events can be a total circus. Is that what this thing is?
Oh, yes. No.
Yeah, it goes without saying.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Everything is so spread out. I mean, you know, the game is going to be in the stadium that's closer to Fort Lauderdale. The convention center is in Miami Beach, and there's, you know, a lot of activities in downtown Miami. So, I mean, it's kind of when it was in the Bay Area in San Francisco, the game was in Santa Clara, but yet everything was either in San Jose or downtown San Francisco. So if anybody knows the geography of these places, that tells you how spread out all the activities are.
Is this fun for a reporter or just kind of your life being made more difficult?
Well, it's fun to see, quote, our team in this environment. This is why we get in the business for stuff like this. I mean, it's a grind, but I'm not complaining.
Yeah. Coach Reed is keeping the team in Kansas City this week and trying to get in as much work as he can before they jet off to Miami with all the distractions down there. Does that approach make sense to you?
I think so, because he's been there. He knows the media demands that take place down there because you have a lot more press conferences, and then you have a lot more because the TV networks are paying a lot of money to televise these games, a lot more one-on-one interviews that take place in addition to the formal news conferences. So because of the media demands down there, the limited times that you actually have the team together for practices and meetings and sessions and everything like that, I think it's best to jam everything in this week to at least have the base of what you want to do before you go down there.
So expecting to get Pat Mahomes as a guest on Up to Date this week might be a stretch,
yeah,
I gather.
Yeah, it's highly questionable.
Highly questionable. His time will be spent elsewhere. Yeah. That's KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund. Greg, always appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Well, you bet the Chiefs are going to the Super Bowl for the first time in half a century. But what does that matter? Commentator Victor Wishna offers just one reason in this long-in-coming edition of A Fan's Notes.
I want to tell you a story. There are thousands like it. On Sunday, inside Arrowhead Stadium, there were about 74,000 stories. But this is mine. When I was a little kid, that's how these kinds of stories always start, the centerpiece of our living room was the object we called Mom's Football. Encased in lucite, it perched on the brick ledge of the fireplace, right next to the glass bowl that was home to Herman, my hermit crab. Sometimes, when my mom wasn't home, I would take the ball from its case and study the odd scrawled names. Mike Garrett, Otis Taylor, Len Dawson, Buck Buchanan, Bobby Bell. I imagined the importance they must hold to others, or possibly to myself, like distant relatives whose legend I had not yet learned. In a way, my own history starts the year following Super Bowl IV, when, on Christmas Day, 1971, my mother introduced her parents to their future son-in-law. They would later joke, I think it was a joke, that they didn't remember meeting him. After all, the divisional playoff between the Chiefs and Miami Dolphins, still the longest game in NFL history, had just gone into a second overtime. My dad, a New Yorker who was more into baseball, was smart enough to cancel their dinner reservations. A year later, my parents were married. But it would be well more than a decade before the Chiefs saw another playoff game. I grew up in those dark days of the 70s and 80s, but there was always Mom's football and Super Bowl IV, the myth on which those of us too young to remember it personally were raised. By the 90s, Mom and I were averaging one or two trips to Arrowhead a season, and when I moved 1,000 miles away, we would talk after almost every game. Sometimes it was just a quick email. Here's one I got right after the Chiefs had blown a 2-touchdown fourth-quarter lead to the Cleveland Browns. I'll just read the whole thing. Well, all of which is to say, I have always blamed my mother for this curious condition of being a sports fan, represented most by a strange, often discomforting passion for the Kansas City Chiefs. When she passed away in 2008, I also got her football. As a Chiefs fan, Sunday at Arrowhead was the greatest day of my life. Okay, besides, of course, my own wedding day and the birthdays of my two children, both Chiefs fans, by the way. And as with those milestones, which I lamented my mom hadn't lived to see, I realized just how close she was. So, surrounded by multitudes cheering the final kneel down, I savored my own quiet moment. They did it, Mama. Like I said, this story, my story, is not special. That's the point. It's shared. 50 years after signing my mom's ball, Hall of Famer Bobby Bell presented the Lamar Hunt Trophy to Lamar Hunt's own son. And Travis Kelce captured the relief and joy of generations when he screamed into the mic, "It's been 7 years coming, baby!" And, well, he was only off by 43 years. Each year, the names of my mom's football had begun to fade a little more. But Sunday night, I could swear they were glowing. Win or lose in Miami, this doesn't feel like a culmination or even a redemption, but a continuation, a dawning, perhaps the beginning of a championship era. Another roster of greats to be remembered. A new myth in the making.
Victor Wishna is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. Tomorrow we sit down with the new leader of Kansas City's American Jazz Museum. That's Rashida Phillips, and she'll join me here in the studio. I'll ask her about any plans she has to revitalize the institution. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.